Hi there, I'm Katie Green.
Hi, I'm Dan Green, and welcome back to the Greening Out podcast. And today we're joined by James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We're going to be talking about his new documentary, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. Thanks so much for coming on the show, James.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So, James, I'd like to start, first of all, by asking you the question I think for me is sort of most important. Why did you want to make this documentary and why now?
Two very good questions. I think they're somewhat related, but I guess my answer to this would be that when I started discovering all of the information that led to me creating the Corbett Report, which really covers all sorts of issues, social and political and geopolitical and economic and all of these other things, I think that it really struck me that the root issue of all of this is the central banking issue. And of course, that takes different forms in different countries, but the prime example in the age of Pax Americana is the American Central Bank, the Federal Reserve. And I came at this information through documentaries like The Money Masters, which back in the mid-1990s did an excellent job, an admirable job of really condensing all of this hundreds of years of history down into a 3-hour documentary that really thoroughly examines this in a great degree of detail. But it struck me that that type of 3-hour exploration of a subject is probably too much for a lot of people to handle, and that now here we are a couple of decades later, and I really wanted to bring this issue back to the forefront, because again, I think it is the root issue of so many of the other problems that we're dealing with as a society. So I've attempted to summarize this in my documentary, and I hope that the structure that I've given this documentary indicates that this is not just a problem that exists in our current time and space, but this is really an historical phenomenon that was well understood by generations and generations of Americans, let alone people around the world, for a very long time. That sense, that understanding of how the monetary issue and the idea of a central bank is such an important part of our economy and our lives has been actually actively removed from the education system, so that in history class, most people might learn some passing details about the central bank, but probably won't learn anything of any great substance, let alone the types of debates, the really rancorous debates that have rocked American history for the first 100, 150 years of the country's existence over the existence of a central bank. So I wanted to bring that conversation back to the forefront and really tackle this in a way that not only, I hope, will be a good introduction for people who've never heard of the Federal Reserve or don't really understand what it does, but even for people who do have an understanding of the Federal Reserve, people who are already on board with the idea that of the End the Fed movement, for example, I think there's a lot of details about how the Federal Reserve operates that even a lot of people in that movement don't necessarily understand very well. So I wanted to use the Federal Reserve's own words to try to show what it really is and to unmask the cartel that is really running the American economy.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I think you've done a very good job of it. Actually, I've seen The Money Masters as well myself, and I know what you mean. It is it's very long, and it's quite. I don't mean to say dense in that way, but it's like there's a lot in it, you know, and it's really it's very sort of packed in. But like as you start the documentary, you start by asking a very simple question, and that's just simply, you know, where does money come from? And that seems like a really simple question, but yeah, and the interviews in the Occupy, with the Occupy movement in Vancouver, I believe it is, in the film, it shows that a lot of people are very, very ignorant of this question, you know, and they don't seem to realize that you can find on the internet, online, exactly where money comes from, but for some reason, just the populace at large is completely ignorant of it.
It is somewhat perplexing, isn't it? And it's certainly not my intention to highlight those types of answers to make fun of those people in particular or their intelligence. I don't for a minute doubt that these are otherwise quite intelligent people who would be able to grasp the concepts of money creation quite easily if it was ever explained to them. But I think it's the shock of hearing this question asked in a serious manner. Where does money come from? Because I think the only time we ever hear this question growing up, or at least the only time I ever heard it, was in that joke. Where does money come from? Oh, it grows on trees. That was the only way that I ever heard this discussed when I was growing up in my entire schooling. Why is that? Why have we never actually seriously considered this question, which is a very real question that deserves an answer? And it has an answer, which, as you say, is quite easy to find, and yet most people never actually hear this question posed. So I can understand people might become defensive and might just say the first thing that comes to their mind when they're suddenly confronted by this question. And hopefully, in at least asking this question in a serious way, we can get people to confront that blind spot and get them to at least consider why it is that they've never really tackled this issue, why it is they've never confronted this in their own history or education.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, certainly my schooling, there was absolutely no such thing as an economics class in school. In fact, I only learned about economics when I was in my 20s. And before that, the only reason I sort of got into this kind of thing of where money comes from and that is because I knew a lot of people who were, like, socialists, and they made some very compelling, very emotional arguments, but nothing they ever said was actually backed up economically. I mean, they said a lot of things that sounded great, but then when I looked into economics, I realized, well, nothing actually stands up here. And that's what made me start to realize that, you know, a knowledge of economics is more important. A lot of people just think it's some kind of weird, boring, abstract, arcane subject. But when you get really into it, you start to realize it's important for all aspects of your life.
It is actually a fundamental issue for our life, especially the lives that we live in this exceptionally interconnected economy where we are all connected through currency. And this is not necessarily something that's held throughout history. I mean, obviously, currencies have varied greatly from time to time and place to place. But in our modern age, in our, you know, modern developed Western democracies, we are bound together usually by a national currency that is usually bound up with legal tender laws, so that the government basically tells people you have to have these pieces of paper in order to pay your taxes and you have to accept them for any type of debt, which basically means that this is going to be the dominant currency. So we've had this kind of foisted upon us, and because of that, because these pieces of paper are so monolithic and have so completely pervaded our consciousness, we tend to just conflate the two. Money is this currency. Currency is money. And we don't really differentiate and see that, no, money doesn't necessarily have to be that. And how did it come to be this? What is the story of the creation of the central banks? And how did they get these powers? And what did we do before that point? I mean, all of these are very fascinating questions with fascinating stories behind them. And again, I have faith in the viewership out there that when people are confronted with these ideas and start to really ponder it, they will see that, yes, this is actually a fascinating story, but it's interesting that we've had it hammered into our heads since the time we were very small, and of course not being taught about economics. We were just given this vague kind of idea that, oh, economics is boring and dry, and look at all these jargony words, you won't enjoy it at all, go out and, you know, play sports and have fun. I think it's incredible when you start to look at some of the very, I mean, fascinating stories from the history here, talking about, for example, the Jekyll Island meeting and the creation of the Federal Reserve. But also, as you say, this is such a fundamental issue that affects literally, I mean, every transaction that we make in our lives that has anything to do with this money, which in this day and age is almost every transaction that we make, is affected by this. And we are affected by forces that not only we don't control, but in many ways we don't even understand or we don't even know exist. And that, to my mind, is the very insidious form of enslavement that is referred to in this title, where it is a type of enslavement where people are being dictated and their entire lives and their career choices and all of these things are being dictated by forces they don't even understand, they don't even see. And that was something that I was hoping to shine light on with this documentary.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And you mentioned the story itself, and when you kind of describe, like, the story of how they got together, it's like something out of a novel, you know, like all these guys and they met after dark and they only, you know, they got on a train and they only used each other's first names. Not even the servants on the train, you know, would be able to identify who they were. And then even the fact that it was called Jekyll Island, you know, it's almost like it's been made up.
It is. I mean, it's so fascinating that this story, again, is as I say in the documentary, it's like something out of some sort of detective novel or something, but it's actually true. I mean, this is a real story of what really happened. And it's the kind of story that if you did try to just portray this in a movie, like this is how, you know, the central bank came into being, you would be laughed at. It would be, oh, that's just ridiculous. That's just Hollywood. But in fact, no, this was the real story of how the Federal Reserves really came into existence. And the perhaps the most flabbergasting part of this is that this is an actual admitted conspiracy that was admitted to by the conspirators themselves. And I include in the documentary the link to Frank Vanderlip's Saturday Evening Post article on this from about 25 years after the meeting itself, where he admitted to having done this, to participated in this secret conclave, where he wrote, "I was as secretive, indeed as furtive as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System." Again, it's all admitted. It's out in black and white. It's in the open. It's completely documented. This is not disputed history. And yet, again, if you talk about things like the Jekyll Island meeting and the creation of the Federal Reserve, you were referred to as a conspiracy theorist in the derogatory sense of that term, as if you're just talking craziness that you made up off the back of a lunchbox or a cereal box or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is the astounding part of this, that the actual history can be derided as some sort of crazy talk by people who don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting as well how you take it right back, because that's where it really starts to hit home for us, because it goes back to the Bank of England, something that we are still dealing with in this country. And there's for example, there's a lot of talk just now in Scotland about what they're calling Scottish independence, but they're talking about keeping the pound, and you're just you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall telling people, don't use the word independence and talk about still being tied to, this fractional reserve banking system.
Absolutely. Well, that if I had any message for my Scottish brethren, it would be, yes, independence, great, devolve from the system and make it more local and all of that. I'm completely behind it. But if it's going to be some sort of sovereignty association and you still use the pound and all of this, then you're really still controlled by the same forces. And absolutely, I couldn't agree more. That trying to get out of the political system without getting out of the economic system is a pipe dream, because one controls the other.
Yeah, and then they're even talking about retaining EU membership and this kind of thing, and it's just, you get me talking for hours, but it's very frustrating. But what was interesting as well, going back to you talk about the creation of the Bank of England and the Bank of North America, and it seems to sort of stem out of debt incurred by war at the time. And then what I thought was later, when you mentioned the Panic of 1907, which, obviously then led to the creation of the Fed as we know it, it seems like before that it was economic warfare, and it seems like J.P. Morgan had an awful lot to do with that.
Well, that's a very astute observation. Certainly, the proximate cause for the creation of all of the central banks that have come about in American history has been some sort of emergency. And again, as you say, usually war, but in the case of the Federal Reserve, an economic emergency. But it is the order out of chaos idea. It is that when there is chaos, people will clamor for a solution. And who do you turn to in that case? Well, you have to turn to the government. What is the government going to do? What can they do in that case? Well, create a central bank. So that's exactly what happened as the Continental Currency, which was the currency that the Continental Congress had issued to support the Revolutionary War effort, as that started to be inflated away into nothingness because of overspending, as well as actually a coordinated, a sophisticated counterfeiting operation by the British as an attempt to take down the Continental Currency. Well, that worked stunningly well, so that by the end of the war, basically a wheelbarrow full of Continental Currency wouldn't be enough to buy a wheelbarrow full of provisions. So there had to be some sort of change in that system. So that led to the creation of the Bank of North America to control the issuance of the nation's currency. And when the Revolutionary War came to an end, and it was suddenly a peacetime, and they were writing the Constitution and all of this, people didn't really see the need for a central bank during a peacetime. So it basically devolved back down into a local bank. And it was Alexander Hamilton who came along, the same man who believed that George Washington should be anointed king for life and they should just institute an American monarchy. He was also the person who believed that a debt is a wonderful thing. It's a blessing for a country because it would allow the United States to establish its credit as a nation. And that was very important for him, as opposed to some of his rivals in the so-called Founding Fathers, as if they're all one homogenous group. They certainly weren't. They were definitely fighting on a number of different issues, one of which was the central banking issue. And of course, Thomas Jefferson being probably the leading opponent of that idea. But anyway, Alexander Hamilton won, and they did create the first Bank of the United States shortly after the signing of the Constitution. And that bank continued for the duration of its 20-year charter to act as a central bank before it was eventually disbanded. And it ultimately disbanded or was dechartered in 1811. And of course, the very next year, it was the War of 1812, and war once again causing an immense amount of spending on the U.S. government's part, which necessitated once again, well, what are we going to do? We're having all of these monetary pressures. Let's create another central bank. So the Second Bank of the United States was chartered in 1816 and had a 20-year charter again. And as that charter was coming up for renewal, of course, Alexander Hamilton made it a plank of his entire re-election campaign, in fact, that he would not sign the renewal charter for the bank. And that was a pretty bold move at the time. It wasn't at all clear that the public was going to support that, but in the end, they did. There was a lot of public... the public was very wary of the Second Bank of the United States and who was in control of it. Again, just like the Bank of England, like the First Bank of the United States, like the Bank of North America before it, it was a privately owned central bank that loaned money to the government at interest, which is just a mind-boggling idea unless you happen to be one of the people who is granted that power to create money out of nothing and then loan it to the government at interest. So the public was very wary of that, and they supported Jackson. He won his re-election, and the Second Bank of the United States was dechartered in 1836, and for a period of 70-plus years, there was no central bank in the United States. It was a period known as free banking. That was modified somewhat after the Civil War or during the Civil War. There were some acts that were passed that created a federal banking system, and it wasn't exactly like the free banking era, but at any rate, there wasn't a formal central bank. And there wasn't one created, as I say, for 77 years after the Second Bank of the United States, which, again, as you say, was necessitated by another type of emergency, this time not war, but by the Panic of 1907, which some people have described, and I think quite rightly so, as a financial false flag operation, which is, I mean, it's an interesting concept, but basically J.P. Morgan, who was at the very least the sort of center of the American finance industry at the time, and someone who was kind of looked upon as the central banker of the United States in the absence of a formal central bank, he was the one who precipitated the panic, at least according to a lot of accounts out there. That's certainly not mainline history, but that is something that's been argued by many people, that Morgan started the panic by spreading rumors about some of his competitors and then allowing them to go under. And then he came forth as the savior, saying that, the story goes that he locked a bunch of bankers up in his study and wouldn't let them out until they agreed to finance $25 million worth of emergency financing for some of these firms that were in threat of going under. So this big shakeup occurs on the New York Stock Exchange and on Wall Street in 1907. It shakes the American financial system to its core. It scares the public, who have lived through periods of great financial turmoil for generations, and they are convinced by this panic that there really does need to be some sort of control on the banking industry. And again, what form can that control possibly take other than a central bank? What they did not count on is that the very money trust that they were so completely against, that was the whole reason that they wanted to form this central bank in the first place, to stop the bankers from running the economy, was the same money trust that ended up creating that central bank. And it was a somewhat indirect method, as we talked about. It was the Jekyll Island meeting was really the genesis of what became the Federal Reserve. But the actual proposal that they came out of that Jekyll Island meeting with was forwarded by Senator Aldrich, one of the participants in that Jekyll Island meeting, and was eventually shut down by Congress because, again, the people really understood Senator Aldrich and his connections to the various banking houses and banking families, and he was part of the banking elite insiders, so people distrusted whatever came out from him, including his legislation. But the legislation was basically dusted off, modified a little bit, and then passed on behalf of Representative Carter Glass and Senator Robert Owen in 1913, and that was how the Federal Reserve really came to be, yet again through an emergency type situation where people thought that the solution that they were clamoring for was going to give them one thing, and in fact, it gave them the exact opposite of what they had been hoping for.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy when you actually, you get into things like fractional reserve banking and things like that, and you start to see how just such a madness it is. But again, it's one of these things that you've got your average person on the street and you speak to them at fractional reserve banking and they're kind of, they look at you as if you've, you know, walked off a spaceship or something.
Yeah, exactly right. As if you're someone visiting from Mars. It is kind of, again, it's mystifying how people don't really understand some of these basic concepts, but it is important to understand that a lot of people still believe, truly believe, that when they go to the bank and they get a loan, that they are actually getting money that is sitting there in the bank's vaults, that has maybe been lent to the bank by other customers making deposits or something along those lines, which, of course, is absolutely not the case. When a commercial bank makes a loan to a client, it is making that money literally out of thin air and injecting it into the person's account by virtue of its charter as a bank in the Federal Reserve System. It's important to understand the Federal Reserve is not itself the mechanism or the origin of the fractional reserve banking system. The fractional reserve banking system was in play before the Federal Reserve ever came into being. But the Federal Reserve is the lender of last resort, i.e. it is the institution that is supposed to undergird this entire system of fractional reserve banking. So that, for example, back in the panic of 1907, if the Knickerbocker Trust Company or whatever financial institution was out there was speculating with its clients' funds or doing whatever, and didn't have enough money to back up all of the deposits because of the fractional reserve system. If enough people get wind of some shady dealings going on at that bank, then they'll go and try to withdraw their money at the same time. If everybody comes and does that, then the bank will have to admit that it doesn't have that much money and it will go under. Everyone will lose their savings. Everyone will end up getting hurt. This is a horrible thing. So the idea behind a central bank is that, well, then the central bank will act as the sort of backstop. If there is that type of run on a bank, then the Federal Reserve will act as the overarching umbrella organization that can provide the emergency funding to at least make sure that everybody gets their money and that the bank itself doesn't collapse. And this is sort of the undergirding that makes that fractional reserve system at least seem a little bit nicer, because there aren't so many bank runs anymore. We are living in an era where we're not accustomed to seeing lines of people trying to all get their money from the bank at the same time, because at the very least people have the sort of psychological effect of being soothed by the fact that there is a central bank, you know, that type of thing doesn't happen anymore. So that it basically serves a sort of psychological function, as well as the actual mechanisms that it performs in the markets to set interest rates and the other functions that it does as the central bank.
Yeah, and G. Edward Griffin in the documentary, he does a brilliant job, as he always does, of describing fractional reserve banking. And also, another aspect of this that I wanted to get to was, I didn't quite realize, for example, until I watched, I knew about the Federal Reserve and that, but I didn't realize, like, until I watched the documentary, like, how influential the New York Fed is, and how bizarrely confusing the whole structure is with the boards and the committees and all these things. I mean, it seems like it's intentionally confusing.
Oh, I certainly think it is. I think that's absolutely part of the system. The official story is that what they were trying to do was create something called a decentralized central bank. And this was something of a compromise of what was the sort of political debate, the economic debate that was taking place at the time the Federal Reserve came about, between the people who were arguing that they didn't want this to be a political mechanism, because then politics and the politicians could control the money supply, and that would be a bad thing. But then there were the people who were worried about the money trust and the bankers controlling it. So this was some way of, I guess, trying to effect a type of division of powers, so that that there is a public element and a private element to the Federal Reserve banking system, and these two elements are not exactly pitted against each other, but certainly separated, and therefore you can, I guess, the idea is that the interests will balance themselves out, which I think has proven demonstrably false over the decades. But as you say, I mean, it creates this very confusing structure where you have a board of governors that is really the political, overtly political element of this, of people who are appointed by the president, from lists that are given to him by the Wall Street bankers, of course, but at any rate, appointed by the president. And then you have the Federal Open Market Committee that includes not only the governors, but also representatives from the regional reserve banks, and then the regional reserve banks themselves, whose boards are created. And even the composition of the boards of the regional reserve banks is, again, confusing. There's all sorts of categories and tranches of who sits on these boards. Some of them are appointed by the banks. Some of them are from other industries, specifically not from banking. And there's different rules about how these board members are chosen, etc., etc. Again, it gets quite confusing when you get into the minutiae of it. But I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that ultimately you do have these private bankers sitting there at the table in the Federal Open Market Committee, really setting the monetary policy for the United States, which is just the most blatant conflict of interests imaginable. You have the private bankers sitting there at the table deciding when and how to expand the money supply, how to set the federal funds rate to that is the base interest rate upon which the entire economy is really based. I mean, it's such an insane system when you start to look at it, and it is so self-evidently, as J. Edward Griffin describes in the documentary, it is a cartel. I mean, it is the private banking interests who got control over the money supply itself of the country and expanding and contracting it as they see fit for the purposes of running up bubbles and then collapsing them and shearing the flock every now and then, as has happened again decade after decade. So it is a confusing system in its minutiae, but I think when you actually step back and take a look at the bigger picture, it's not so complicated, and I think that the complications are there to be that kind of pitfall for people.
Yeah, and you mentioned it's like an insane system as well, because you also point out the fact that during these bailouts, it's described as a circular system, because during these bailouts, you have people on the board who work for banks or companies, and they're just bailing out their own banks and companies.
It's, again, it's so blatant, it's so undeniable that you almost have to do a double check just to see what's going on. But it's right there and it's documented. In fact, I point in the documentary to a Government Accountability Office report that was issued in 2011 that was looking at $16 trillion of the emergency bailout loans and other emergency funding that was provided by the Federal Reserve in the immediate wake of the 2008 crisis. And this is only $16 trillion. The total amount of emergency funding provided by the Fed has been estimated at over $29 trillion. But the GAO back in 2011 looked at $16 trillion of that. And they documented all of these very clear-cut cases of conflicts of interest. The actual report itself stops short of saying conflict of interest. It says that this needs to be reviewed. But at the time, Senator Bernie Sanders and others came out and called it for what it was, which was just blatant conflict of interest. So some examples that I cite in the documentary include the chief executive of General Electric, Jeffrey Immelt, who was sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. At the exact same time, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York provided $16 billion in financing to General Electric. So he's directing it, again, directly to his own company. Or you had Jamie Dimon, of course, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, who was also a member of the New York Fed at that time, and directed $391 billion in emergency Fed lending to his own bank. So those are just some examples, and there were others documented in that report that show that the conflict of interest is there. And then I think the real amazing part of that was that's immediately followed up in the documentary by an exchange between Bernie Sanders and Ben Bernanke back when he was the chair of the Federal Reserve, in an exchange talking specifically about those kinds of conflicts of interests. And Ben Bernanke pretty much flat out admits, he says, you raise an important point, which is that this is not something the Federal Reserve created. This is in the statute. Congress in the Federal Reserve Act said this is the governance of the Federal Reserve, and more specifically, that bankers would be on the board of the Federal Reserve. And so he's basically saying, yes, there is a conflict of interest built into the system, but Congress created it. So, you know, we're just working with the system that exists. It's a pretty stunning admission of what the Federal Reserve really is at its base, at its heart, is a giant conflict of interest. It's the bankers presuming to run the economy and look over the banking industry while they're at it. And again, they don't even really deny this. It's just sort of, well, you know, Congress created it, so what are you going to do? And of course, when you look at the actual story, it wasn't necessarily Congress that created it. It was the bankers who wrote the legislation that became the Federal Reserve Act.
Yeah. And I like as well when we get when you get to the third section, you're in the Fed section, and you start to connect like these powerful central banking interests with these roundtable groups, you know, like the Council on Foreign Relations and things like that, and what seems to be their agenda, global governance.
Absolutely. Well, this is the important part of this, because I think that it comes to a point where we can, again, we can get lost down the rabbit holes of the minor details of how this system works in every single capacity and function of the Federal Reserve. But at the end of the day, the bigger picture is that once you understand this system of monetary creation and how the money supply of the United States and most of the Western countries, as I say, is created out of debt, is created as debt that's owed back to banks out of nothing, you start to realize that at the end of the day, this isn't really about the accumulation of dollars and cents by bankers. They, at the end of the day, can't care that deeply about a tool that they themselves create on a daily basis. This isn't what the agenda is ultimately about, which of course begs the question what the agenda is about. And I hope I don't give it short shrift in the documentary, because it's an important point, but I think we can see quite clearly that ultimately this is not about money, this is about power, it's about control. And and this is documented, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of documenting this, but one of the most blatant when we're talking about the Federal Reserve is that, as I point out with the Jekyll Island meeting, it's mostly J.P. Morgan-connected interests there at Jekyll Island creating the Federal Reserve Act and benefiting from the creation of specifically the New York Federal Reserve. But it's the very same J.P. Morgan-connected banking elite that end up forming the Council on Foreign Relations just 8 years after the Federal Reserve itself is created. In 1921 in New York, they register the CFR, and the first director of the CFR is John W. Davis, who just happens to be J.P. Morgan's personal lawyer. Or you have the first president of the CFR, who's also J.P. Morgan connected. It gets quite, I mean, comical at a certain point, that it's basically just a banking operation. And the CFR has had from its very inception, if you go back and read even some of its earliest publications, the idea of the creation of a new world order, which again, has we've been taught is some sort of silly conspiratorial phrase that only those conspiracy theorists use. But of course, it's been used time and time and time again by politicians talking about the creation of a global government. And exactly as we've seen time and again throughout various crises, in the wake of the 2008 crisis, we had at the 2009 G20 summit led by Gordon Brown, who was hosting it at the time, that they again were aiming specifically at the creation of a new world order. And they were talking about a government, a global governmental system to handle these types of financial crises, and the creation of the G20 out of the G8, and all of these changes that started to come from the political side of things. So I think that's ultimately what this agenda is ultimately about. And I think we have to understand that at the end of the day, I mean, I think one of the answers that we can supply to the question of what is money is that money is power. It represents power or leverage or sort of capital in not only the economic sense, but in the political sense as well. And I think the accumulation of that capital is ultimately what the bankers are interested in, because at the end of the day, they intend to spend it all on the creation of their global governmental system.
Yeah. And you always see it as well in the mainstream media. It's like they put out these sort of boogeymen for us to be scared of, like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, or I think it's IS as it's called, you know. And it's such a distraction, because it's not really them who are going to enslave humanity if they exist at all in the form that we're being told they do. I mean, it's these New World Order types who are the people we should be really scared of.
Well, it's interesting. There was a Henry Kissinger quote, and I won't attempt to paraphrase it too closely at this point, because I don't have it in front of me, but there was a quote, I believe from before 9/11, where Kissinger was saying something to the effect that terrorists, anyone who opposes the global governing structures are terrorists. And I think it was made in connection with the battle of Seattle, the WTO protests at the time. Basically, people who are protesting globalization are clearly the terrorists. And I think that's the way in which this is being posited, that that terrorism, of course, we tend to think of, you know, turbaned men trying to attack Western countries in whatever way they can, but ultimately the way the system sees that is just whoever is opposed to their agenda. And I think that that we have to understand that includes pretty much everyone. I mean, when Bush said if you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, I think he quite literally meant that, and it's just a question of who he meant by us.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's interesting because, I mean, this kind of thing could get you down, but in your last part of the documentary is actually there, it's quite optimistic in a way, you know, because, like, for example, what interested me was the footage of the End the Fed rallies in Germany. And I know it's been spreading like about Europe. I mean, I would love to see, I know there's a Facebook page, but I would love to see a proper sort of End the Bank of England movement in Britain. But, like, I think we need more education in this country before we get to that point.
That's true. And I think that the when and if such a movement arises, I mean, I certainly hope it will do the sort of job of spreading the truth about the Bank of England specifically, because, again, it's a different beast than the Federal Reserve with its own history. And although it did start as that private bank that I document in the documentary in 1694, it has changed and been morphed and been sort of amended by Congress, or not Congress, Parliament, and things of that nature since then. So it, I mean, at least nominally functions in a different way now than it did even 100 years ago and all of that. So there is, again, a fascinating history to document there. And I really do hope that this idea starts to catch on and starts to be localized. I think there should be a movement to end the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan and the Bank of Canada and all of these other central banks as well. But again, that takes a different form in each country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it has to be. Yeah, I know what you mean. And also, you bring up as well, like, different solutions. You know, you mentioned the Money Masters at the start, and Bill Still seems to be sort of in favor of, like, these kind of greenback notes, like, were issued, you know, under Abraham Lincoln's government. So that we understand it, debt-free government-issued notes, then the supply would be controlled by the government. But I don't know if I'm just paranoid, but do you see a kind of a danger in that idea? Because then could the government not just sort of contract the money supply and things like that when they want to?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm a voluntarist, which I guess you could describe as a flavor of anarchism. So I certainly don't have any faith in the idea that any government is ever going to be able to responsibly hold the purse strings of a nation and really use that power responsibly. I think that the idea of the greenback type of idea is certainly absolutely better than the system that we have now and could potentially be used for good. But I certainly share your skepticism on that point. But what I was really trying to do in the third part of this documentary was to show that there are a lot of different ideas out on the table, and I don't even necessarily agree with all of the ideas that are presented here or all of the ideas that are floating around out there about what to do to end the Fed. But my point really at the end of the day is that these ideas do not have to be exclusionary. It doesn't have to be you all have to, you know, replace this one monolithic idea of what currency is and how it should function in the economy with this other monolithic idea of what currency is and how it should function in the economy. My idea is let's open up the doors, let's blast it wide open and have lots of different currencies competing with each other and complementing each other. It doesn't necessarily have to be competitive in that sense, because something that I think has gone over the heads of a lot of people, because again, we've been trained into thinking that money is this one thing, is that money has a lot of different functions. Money can act as a store of value. Money can act as a unit of account. Money can act as a unit of exchange. These are all very different functions. And why do we have it in our heads that they all have to be fulfilled by the one, just one currency? And in fact, why does any one function have to only be one currency? We can have multiple different currencies that we can use in different ways for different transactions. And certainly if you want to have some sort of national currency, it's going to look different than a local currency, which is also going to look different than a decentralized currency like Bitcoin or something that can be used across borders and around the world. And I don't want to put all of my eggs in any one basket. I just want people to have the choice of what to use. And I really do have faith that when that system is blown wide open and all of these different currencies are out there and competing and different ideas are springing up in different places and people are looking at communities that are doing well and seeing how they can apply them in their own local area, I think that is a much, much healthier system and a more stable system at the end of the day. Because again, all of these panics, we are taught, well, here's this national currency and look, it's being issued by all these different banks and we have bank runs. Oh, what are we going to do? Well, let's centralize it. Let's centralize the power. It's always from the order, from the chaos, they always want to bring the order of making everything more central, which is exactly the push towards global government. When the national currencies of various nations start failing, again, they're going to say, well, what, this is why we need a EU, this is why we need a regional currency. This is eventually how they're going to weave the system into one unified global whole, which to me is a nightmare society scenario, because again, even if it were to be run by angels descended from heaven to rain sunshine and lollipops down on everyone, this generation, well, who's to say a generation down the road it won't be, those same seats of power won't be held by people with different motivations? And how naive would we be to believe that somehow, you know, human nature has changed and that will never occur again? That's just ridiculous. And so I am very much opposed to the idea of centralization as a solution. All I want is decentralization and people to have the choice of what currencies to use in different situations. So in the documentary, I provide the example of state banking. I provide the idea of a mutual credit system, as in Ithaca, New York, where they have Ithaca Hours. And I talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Again, very different ideas. And I more or less am interested in some of them and in certain situations. But again, it's not really what I'm interested in that should be of interest to anyone. It should be just the idea that there are these different ideas out on the table. And why aren't we exploring them? Why isn't there more discussion around this issue? So that's really the point of the third part of this documentary. And I think the saddest part of the documentary is that's the spirit in which I'm putting this forward. It's not me saying these are the ideas and we must use these ones. It's me saying, look, there's all sorts of ideas, let's start exploring them. And sadly, some of the people involved in the End the Fed movement, who you would expect to be on board with a documentary like this, you know, really putting this in front of people, are choosing not to promote it because, well, oh, you talked about this idea and we don't support that idea. So again, I think that's sad and it's to the detriment of everyone, but I think people will see through that. And I really do believe the idea of currency competition and just an open market in ideas will win out over the people who want us all chained to one particular system.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same as you. I think there could be different currencies that could coexist with each other. I don't see why, you know, any reason why that couldn't be a good thing.
I think one of the major points, I don't know if you'll agree, James, of voluntarism, as I see it anyway, is choice. You want options. It's not that I'm not saying I agree with all the options, but these are the options, and you are a human being, hopefully intelligent enough to make up your own mind. And that's sort of what voluntarism is to me anyway. And I think that that's important.
And it's the fact that we don't have that choice just now. You know, we've just basically, I know you can use Bitcoin for certain things, but it's not the same as using, you know, the obviously government debt money.
Yeah.
Well, exactly right. And again, that's because of these legal tender laws that say that, well, you must accept certain types of currency for debt obligations, and you must use this type of currency to pay your taxes, which you must pay or you will be locked in a cage. So there's a lot of different things that they weave around us to make sure that their currency becomes the dominant one. And I think I think you're right. I mean, I think ultimately my position as a voluntarist is to say, yeah, I certainly absolutely don't agree with every decision that everyone's going to make. But as long as they're making that voluntarily and of their own volition, and they're not, you know, trying to force me onto their system, then who am I to come along and tell them that that's the wrong decision for them? I mean, I can tell them that, but they don't have to listen to me, and why should they?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, there are things out there, the resource-based economy ideas that some people have. I think it is destined to fail. I think they absolutely do not overcome the economic calculation problem. I think there are serious problems with central planning and ideas like that. But hey, if you want to try to create that system, by all means. I mean, why on earth would you care if I'm opposed to it? I'm not going to stop you from doing it. Go out and prove me wrong. Create that economy that you're talking about. Yeah. And when and if you do, I'll be the first to eat my hat and ask for seconds and say, hey, look, you did it. So so I think that's my idea of what the system could be. It doesn't have to be this system of bars and prisons and locking people away who you disagree with. It can just simply be, well, let's agree to disagree. You can go do your thing. I'll go do my thing and let the best man win. Or not even that situation. Why don't we both win? I mean, it doesn't, again, a lot of these ideas don't have to be directly competitive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as we sort of begin to wrap up here, are you optimistic? I mean, obviously, because these movements, like in the Fed and that, have started to gain momentum, and more people are learning about this kind of thing, this economic structure that they live under. So, are you quite optimistic about the future that we can eventually, hopefully, get rid of this kind of evil?
If I wasn't optimistic about the future, or at least the possibility that we could overcome this, I probably wouldn't have created the documentary in the first place. I mean, clearly, I think that there is, at the very least, there's the opportunity for us to see past this time that we're living through and the way that the structure has been erected around us to what is possible, and that there are things that we can do right now to start implementing them. There is no one that's going to come, at least at this point, with a gun to your head to stop you from using some local community currency. They already exist. They're already there. They are already one way of starting to detach yourself from the system. And it certainly isn't a process that's going to happen all at once or overnight. It's going to be a very slow, very long, painstaking process. But it's better to start that process now, at least while we have the luxury to do so, than to try to start that process during that emergency chaos time, which is always the time where there's an awful lot of genuine pain felt by an awful lot of people who will then start clamoring for the government to do something about it. And that's exactly the situation we've seen increasingly in Europe in recent years, and that's exactly why we've seen, for example, in places like Volos in Greece, they've come up with a mutual credit system there that is now working around the limitations. There's not enough euros to go around, but there's still a lot of people who are willing to work and trade and exchange things. Why don't we just create our own exchange system? So we find these things popping up when the need exists, when the immediate pressing need exists. And I'm here to say, well, these types of ideas already exist in places. Why don't we start using them and building them up now as the bulwark against that type of collapse scenario? And while we're at it, hey, we're removing ourselves from that system of control every time we build one of these systems up. So it's a win-win situation. It is not only possible, it is actually happening right now. I think that's one thing that I want people to take away from this. And it's just a question, to what extent are you going to dip your toes in the water and find out what's happening in your local area and broader in terms of Bitcoin and other things that transcend national boundaries?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. James, thanks so much for this. It's been great having you on. But why don't you tell our audience about your website and the resources and things they can find there?
Absolutely. Well, my website is CorbettReport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. And that is the one-stop shop for all of my various materials, my audio and video media, my articles. There's all sorts of information, thousands of hours of media there for completely free download, as is the documentary completely free for viewing on YouTube, on my website. The best place to go for the documentary itself is CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve. That's where you can find the YouTube video version of this. You can also find links to download the MP3 audio and the MP4 video. You can download an informational pamphlet to help spread the word about the documentary. And if you have watched the documentary and you do appreciate it and you want to support the work monetarily, because sadly enough, we do live in a system where we do need these pieces of paper, I certainly do appreciate monetary support in the form of purchasing a DVD that hopefully then you can use to help unlock other people's minds. And of course, I encourage people to make copies of the DVD, screen the DVD anywhere you can to anyone you can. Obviously, the number one priority is to get the word out. So the DVD is also available for sale there. Again, the best place to go, CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve.
Yeah, and we'll have it all linked up as well, and we'll embed the documentary on our page as well. So, James, thanks so much.
And for more libertarian podcast writings and news, go to www.greeningoutpodcast.co.uk, and James is at www.corbettreport.com.